The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Anusha Bala Subramanian, and I work for the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about a project that the library is working on. It's we're trying to match a $15 million challenge gift to the Central Library Expansion Project, and it's a transformational endeavor that is going to bring you not only a great new auditorium, but also will provide members of the community with a much-needed creative and cutting-edge space that is free and accessible to everybody. And there's a little bit more information about the project and how you can get involved outside on the tables, outside the auditorium. And before I introduce our guest, I just want to take a moment to remind you to silence your cell phones and also to tell you that there's going to be a book signing immediately following the event in the lobby upstairs. Manil Suri was born and raised in Bombay, India. He came to the U.S. to pursue a master's degree and eventually earned a doctorate in applied mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University. He is currently a tenured full professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. But as you know, math is not what he is here to talk about tonight. In his free time, he has distinguished himself as an author. He first published a piece of fiction in English in The New Yorker, and that was The Seven Circles in 2000. And The Death of Vishnu, his first novel, debuted worldwide in 2001. In addition to being published by Norton in the U.S. and Bloomsbury in the U.K., it's been translated into 22 languages and received a whole host of accolades. In 2000, he was named by Time magazine as a person to watch, and he received a Guggenheim Fellowship for fiction in 2004. His latest novel, The Age of Shiva, weaves together the parallel tales of India as a nation and one woman, Meera, both on transformative journeys through independence while facing struggles between modernity and tradition. A rich and intensely layered drama about love of all kinds, maternal, patriotic, and human, it is, as Amy Tan remarked, at once intimate and epic, a balance of sensual beauty and visceral reality. We are honored to have him here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Manil Suri.
Hello, everyone. It's nice to be back in Philadelphia. Anusha was just talking about Time magazine, person to watch. Well, that was 7 years ago, so there's been a lot of watching that's happened since then. But it's finally over, so it's nice that 7 years later, I finally have a new book. Anyway, I thought I would just start by reading a little bit, and then we'll go on to a few questions. I'm going to read you right from the beginning and then read a few other sections afterwards. I've just come back from an Indian book tour, which was amazing. It was five cities and lots of readings and everything. I did lose my voice at every single reading. So when I lose my voice today, that's the end of the show. It's a good way of ending. But you know, hopefully that won't happen for a while. So let me just read you a little bit from the book. Every time I touch you, every time I kiss you, every time I offer you my body, Ashwin, do you know how tightly you shut your eyes as with your lips you search my skin? Do you know how you thrust your feet towards me, how you reach out your arms, how the sides of your chest strain against my palms? Are you aware of your fingers brushing against my breast, their tips trying to curl around something to hold on to, but slipping instead against my smooth flesh? Ashwin, do you know the wetness emerge from my nipples and spill down the slopes of my chest? Is that your tongue that I feel? Are you able to steal a taste or two? Ashwin, your eyes still closed, drops of moisture dappling your nose. Do you know how innocent you look, how helpless, as I guide the nipple towards your mouth? For an instant, I feel like teasing you, drawing my nipple across your lips, but only for a touch, and swinging it away. Watching your tongue dart out in confusion, the fingers still opening and closing and curling, worry beginning to crinkle your face. And that helplessness, that exquisite helplessness in your expression, that need for my body, for the nipple that is yours, for the breast I have so cruelly taken away. Yes, love can be capricious, can it not, my sweet? But of course I relent before I even begin. Your look suffuses me with guilt. I let your mouth close around me. I feel the pressure of your gums, your lips. The power in your jaws surprises me. A little more strength, and I can see there will be pain. Your tongue pulls against my nipple. So practiced, so persuasive, so determined. How does it know what to do? I feel myself responding. Each tug brings liquid flooding up, engorging my breast, pushing out into your insistent mouth. Your feet twist and turn against my belly as you feed. Your hands finally find purchase on my breast. Fingers playing out around tiny palms, your orb, your world held in your hands. I lose myself in the rhythm of your intake. Am I imagining it, or is there a parallel rhythm that echoes inside me? A longing that rises through my body and trembles under my skin. I feel myself flush. I feel the color spread through my chest. Then I see your face, your forehead losing its worry, your eyelids no longer wrinkled tight. I watch the smile trying to train the corners of your mouth, and the heat inside me turns into warmth. There is nothing, I think to myself, as you let go of my nipple and turn to me filled. Nothing that can be as satisfying as this. Afterwards, I lie next to you. You fit so well into my body. Before closing my eyes, I take one last look. Your eyes, your ears, your hands, your feet, all these I check to make sure they're still there, still intact. Even the tiny curl of your manhood, nestling so innocently between the fleshy fold of your thighs. All this I have created. All this has come from me. As I drift off to sleep, I wonder if you will ever know these thoughts that flow through my mind. These soliloquies I address to you, this conversation I keep up in my brain. Perhaps one day I will tell you about the yearning from which you were born, the lives with which you can play, the planets over which you hold sway. Ashwin, the sign in the sky. Ashwin, the constellation of twins. Ashwin, the one who went before you, the one with whom you share your name. You are the hope and the fire, the absolution, the purifier. You will deliver me, will you not, from this life I find myself in? So this is Meera, who's the central character of the story. And this first scene actually occurs about 1965. And after this, we sort of flash back and we go back to how Meera met her husband, Dave. And I should just point out, when I say Dave, it's actually D-E-V. People hear that and they hear Dave. And of course, that's not an Indian name, so it's D-E-V. But it's pronounced very similarly, though not quite the same as Dave. So it's Dave. I'm going to read you a little section about when Meera's first gotten married. And what happens is that through a series of events, she finds herself in a marriage that she's really not at all sure she wants to be in. And this is the scene where she's just been brought to her husband's house. And in addition to Dave, there is the sister, Dave's sister, Hema, who's the one who's talking here. And, she's the one who's mentioned here. Dave's brother's name is Arya, and Arya's wife is Sandhya. So let's just see what happens the first night Meera is there. the electricity was out on Dev Street. "It's gone for the night," Hema announced cheerfully. "We are one of the first ones they cut when the city runs out of power." She held a lit match under a candle to soften its base, then stuck it upright on the arm of a chair. "We are just a government colony, after all. Not like the wealthy area where your father has his house." I sat perched on a charpoy in the only bedroom in the flat, the long gungat of my sari draped over my face like a veil. It was difficult to maintain the pose Dave's mother had taught me, the sagging of the charpoy ropes threatening to topple me. But the position felt as centering as a yoga asana. By concentrating on keeping steady on the bed, I was able to take my mind off the despair closing in on me. "You can speak now, you know. Even take your ghungat off. All the guests have gone. Though you'll have to show your face sooner or later. All those people who've been saying it's your sister who's the prettier one." Hema held up a candle near my head, filling the inside of my ghungat with light and trying to peer through. "Besides, you must be dying under there, not being used to having all the fans off. Tell me, is it true Dev Bhaiya said you had an air conditioner at your house?" "We had two, one in the drawing room and one in Paji's library," but I remained silent. "Well, you at least had lots of servants, didn't you? Dev Bhaiya said your father made a lot of money as a publisher." "Not that we don't have servants, mind you. Well, maybe not a servant exactly, but we do have a Ganga. She comes in to clean the pots. No cook, though. Don't worry, we won't make you work. Not while you're a new Bahu anyway. When Sandhya Didi was a new Bahu, just married to Arya Bhaiya, she didn't have to step into our kitchen even once for the first month. Now Mataji makes her do all the cooking, of course. Though between you and me, her rice clumps so much the Ganga could do it better. I suppose we shouldn't expect you to be good either, being a rich man's girl and everything. I've already told my parents, when I get married, it's going to be to the wealthiest man they can find. Marry for comfort, that's what I want, not for love like you." "Hema," my mother-in-law called, "stop that Dehradun Express tongue of yours and come right out." "Coming, Mataji. Anyway, we'll talk more tomorrow. Tonight this room is yours. Arya Bhaiya and Sandhya Didi are sleeping with us in the other room, even though he's the elder brother. It's going to be tight. Plus, all that rich wedding food must have given Didi gas again. And on top of that, she snores." Hema fluffed up a pillow and laid it at my feet. "You have such pretty toes. But I guess that's what new brides are supposed to have, at least in the beginning. I'm sure my Bhaiya will be very impressed." She skipped to the door. "Enjoy this special night of yours." So what happens after that is, little by little, Meera does manage to win over Hema and all the other family members. And she's still not sure if she wants to be there, but series of events changes things a bit. And the one person that she cannot win over that easily is Sandhya. That's her, Arya's wife, so that's her sister-in-law. So I'm going to read you a little passage about that. I noticed that there are a lot of South Asians in the audience, and I think some of you must have, will identify with some of these things that's mentioned here. And I should just point out for the rest of you, there's this tradition that comes down in India of showing respect by touching someone's feet. And that's what this is about. So I'll just read it. "Each morning after her bath, I would see Sandhya in the courtyard performing her puja of Arya. She would swirl an earthenware lamp resting on a round metal thali in a circle before Arya's face, as one might in front of a picture at a shrine. She would mark his forehead with ash from the platter and sometimes dab on some vermilion and a moistened grain of rice. She would bend her head and wait for him to color the parting in her hair with a line of the vermilion. Then she would bend even lower to touch his feet, first the right, then the left. She would run the same hand over her head to bless herself as she began to rise. The first time I saw this puja, I stood in the kitchen transfixed. The touching of feet was a ritual strictly forbidden by Paji in our house. All this scraping, all this servility, hasn't anyone in this country heard of human dignity? Aren't there enough gods in the temples already to satisfy this national hunger for groveling? We spent 2 centuries licking the boots of the British. Did you ever see them go around prostrating themselves at anyone's feet? Our cousins, of course, had all been taught to perform the ritual at the beginning and end of every visit to show respect to their elders. Paji would yank their heads back up the instant they started to bend. "Did you drop something?" he would demand. "Are you preparing to do push-ups? You can look around on the floor all you want, but I'll slap you if you touch my feet." For a while when we were young, Biji tried to force us to go through the ritual when Paji was not around. "You insolent daughter of an owl, I don't care what your father says. I'll break every bone in your body if you don't touch your grandmother's feet." At other times, she would try to cajole us. "It's a mark of respect, nothing else. What's the harm in bowing before wisdom, before age?" She would tell us stories from the Mahabharata and the Ramayana to further her argument, such as the one where Bharat kept his brother's sandals on the throne when Ram was exiled into the forest. "It's part of our culture, something that's come down to us from the ages," she would say. "It's a dignified custom. You should perform it proudly, not be ashamed." Once Paji found out, he quickly put an end to Biji's efforts. "What can one expect? The children in our village had to wash their parents' feet and drink the water afterwards in respect. Is that what she's going to teach you to do next?" During the first years, Paji told us, there was a time when Biji wouldn't eat anything in the morning until she had touched his feet. She would tell me I was her lord, her protector, her provider, that she couldn't start the day without my blessing. When I stopped her, she would pull my shoes out from under the bed and perform her ceremony over them. When I hid those, she started waiting until I was in the bath to touch my house slippers instead. It was years before I could break her of the habit, before I could keep any footwear lying around unlocked again. So that actually turns out to be a key point in the action that follows. And there's a well-known fast in India that wives keep for their husbands. And the idea is that by keeping this fast, which is from morning to night, it's called Karva Chauth. Karva is a kind of pot, and Chauth is the fourth day of the waning moon. But wives don't eat, and the idea is that by this, they're supposed to help prolong their husbands' lives. So, of course, Meera's father, who's very liberal, Paji, he's always forbidden his wife from doing this, and, you know, she doesn't even know about it. Meera doesn't even know about this fast. But her in-laws are very conservative, and so she finds herself in this ritual and about to do it. Her husband, Dave, actually wants to leave the family and go to Bombay, where he wants to be a singer, but he doesn't have the money for it. And Paji wants to extricate Meera from this conservative family and also send her to Bombay because he wants her to go to college. And he said that he will give the money to Dave, but he's made one condition, that they have to go through this ritual and she cannot touch his feet. If he sees her touch Dave's feet, then he's going to walk out. So anyway, this is what happens at that scene at Karva Chauth. By 8, the guests were all gathered in the courtyard. Mataji had invited her friends to share in the auspicious occasion of my first Karva Chauth. "There's Mrs. Sampath," Hema said, pointing at a woman sitting on the charpoy and kneading her chest. "She says she's going to get a heart attack. since she can't take her blood pressure pills during the fast. Last year she fainted, and the ambulance came and took her away, but people said later it was just to show off. And that's Mrs. Gangwal. She still keeps the fast, even though her husband ran off with her niece 4 years ago. And next to her, Mrs. Pota, whose husband no one's ever seen. The rumor is he's dead. I was having difficulty breathing. My jewelry felt heavy and constraining, the wedding outfit from 2 months ago tight and suffocating across my chest. My scalp was on fire, as if I'd used chili powder, not vermilion, to decorate the parting in my hair. Even the bindi on my forehead itched so fiercely, I felt like scratching it off. So I'm going to skip a little because there are several things about the rituals of Karva Choth, and just skip a bit to this point. "It's risen," Hema shouted, interrupting the ceremonies. "I can see it over there next to the house." You're only supposed to break the fast after you see the moon in the sky. It was indeed the moon, its rounded edge already beginning to clear the treetops. We had been too absorbed in the rituals to notice its stealthy ascent. A hush fell over the congregation. Since I was the newest bride, it was my honor to be the first to break my fast. Sandhya helped me get up and bent down to arrange my foot on the center of the pestle. It felt cold and smooth against my arch, its convexity reassuring as I curled my toes around. Mataji handed me the sifter, and I held it up against the night. My vision swam as I did so. The moon looked a dirty white. I took the glass of milk from Sandhya and prepared to pour my offering to the moon. But I couldn't summon up the silent words that were to accompany this action. The women watched me and waited for their turns as I stood poised with the glass. Should I turn around to ask them what I should be praying for? Sandhya touched me at the shoulder and gently tilted my glass. I watched the thread of milk spill out and connect me to the earth. Dave loomed up in the sifter, his features curiously warped by the weave of the mesh. His nose seemed longer, his forehead too wide, the hollows under his eyes more pronounced. I looked at the blurred outline of his mouth and heard again the directions he had whispered. "Don't worry about Paji. I'll catch you in my arms before you can bend too much. It'll look quite natural. Instead of touching my feet, we'll end it in a hug." Sandhya exchanged the sifter and glass of milk in my hands for the fruit-laden thali I was to offer my mother-in-law. All that was required of me now was to follow Dave's instructions. He would catch me before I could complete my bow and feed me the first morsel to break my fast. Paji would nod approvingly from the charpoy upon seeing that Dave's feet remained untouched. Down at the station, the frontier mail would pull into the platform, ready to bear us away. Steam issuing out of its rearing engine like from the nostrils of an impatient mare. I looked into Dave's eyes and saw he could picture the frontier mail as well. Was Bombay within reach now? Were his calculations proceeding as planned? Paji must surely have the same expression of self-satisfaction on his face. A daughter on her way to college, her life finally lived the way he wanted. Beside me stood Sandhya, her face shining with a serene beauty, like a moon bride descended to earth. I'm not sure what exactly triggered my divergence from the script. A clarity, calm, incisive, emerged from my hunger to reveal the action I had to take. I stared into Dave's eyes, and this time his sureness faltered, his satisfaction dimmed. Realization flooded in, and then alarm as he followed the direction of my gaze. I bent down before I could be swayed by the pleading beginning to distort his face. Too late, he tried to grab me, but I dodged my shoulder out of the way. I descended so fast that an orange fell out of my thali and rolled into the crowd. Dev couldn't pull back his feet, even if he wanted to. There were too many eyes focused on them. He stood rooted where he was, his face ashen, his toes as vulnerable and exposed as a statue's. I touched his right foot first, then his left, as Sandhya had instructed. The skin on his knuckles felt dry and surprisingly smooth. There was a quiver with each contact I made, as if my fingertips were delivering tiny electric shocks to him. I went through the motion of blessing myself by running my fingers through my hair. Then I rose, my head still bowed, ready to accept my father's rage, ready to accept the morsel that would release me from my fast for Dev. Okay, so I'll stop reading there and take questions. Thank you. So I think we have two different mics. People want to ask questions, and there'll be people, you know, just raise your hand, and I think someone's going to help with pointing out. And incidentally, just to give you an added incentive, there's a secret question which, when someone asks me, you will get this free CD, and I'll tell you more about what's in the CD when you ask me that secret question.
Okay. I see a lot of familiar faces, so you know how this works. If you have a question, raise your hand, and we will get a microphone to you. And please wait for the microphone. So do we have questions? Lainey?
Firstly, let me say I really enjoyed this book. But it took me aback because I had read The Death of Vishnu, and I knew that you were making a trilogy. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't quite get was the relationship between this book as a continuation of this trilogy and where it was going for the third book.
Yeah, that's a good question. And when people hear the word trilogy, there's one kind of trilogy where it's the same characters and the same story that's continued. But there's another kind of trilogy which is more thematic. And my idea was always to have three separate books with three discontinuous stories, each one representing one face of this Hindu trinity, which consists of Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. And so Vishnu was the caretaker. He's the caretaker of this building in the first book. And so he represents, you know, he's very close to this deity, Vishnu, who's the caretaker of the universe. In this book, we are talking about Shiva. Shiva is a very different deity. He's an ascetic. He withdraws from the world. And it's his absence that really defines him, because it creates this longing. And so that's the kind of essence that I've distilled out of Shiva, and that's what you find in the book. And there are myths of Parvati and Shiva that are woven in. And then the last one is about Brahma, who's the creator. But more than that, you know, originally my idea was that loosely it would follow this idea of Vishnu dying and then Shiva, who's also called the destroyer, ending the world and then Brahma recreating it. But now the way I look at it is the first book was really a snapshot. It was a snapshot of India in contemporary times, 80s or 90s. This book really tells you how we got there, from independence to this present time. And in the next book, I'm really going to project things into the future. So in that way, you'll get a loose... And instead of trilogy, I've started using the word triptych. So that's the new word, or troika, or something. So just so that people don't get confused. My UK publisher was horrified and said that, okay, don't use the word trilogy. You know, and they haven't used it anywhere in their publicity, because they don't want people to think that you need to read the first book to understand the second.
Another question?
Hi, I actually have two completely different questions, but I'll give them to you at the same time. The first has to do with the reaction that you've gotten in India about this book. I know growing up as an Indian American here, I face a lot of the challenges that I feel are represented in the book between tradition and this so-called notion of liberalism and what it means to grow up and come into your own, trying to balance those two things. And I was just wondering what the sort of reaction is that you get in India, if it is the same as it would be here, or if you've seen it differently. And the second question has to do with, I see the stories as very parallel, India and Meera's, stories, and you can see these same issues of modernity versus tradition and all of that. The one part that I didn't see was this idea of control, and it seems like everybody is trying to control somebody else, control themselves and control somebody else. And yet I wasn't sure where that came in as it relates to India as a nation and how you felt that tied in.
Yeah, that's a great question. I couldn't have planted a better question, so thank you. For the first part, in terms of the reaction in India, I just came back, and the reaction has been very positive. The reviews, there have been some really good reviews where people have really understood it. You know, there's one in DNA by Sampath, and just amazing that, I couldn't have hoped for a better person. The one in India Today, and then there's one on the web by J. Arjun Singh. These are all, very good critics, and they've really, really loved the book. So that's been great. and of course, the most insipid review I got was by someone who interviewed me on Thursday and said, this was for a journal called The Week, and she interviewed me and she said, oh, by the way, do you have a copy of your book at the end? I have to review it too. And on Friday, the review was in The Week. And she must be a very fast reader. So anyway, there are a few of those too. But where your second question is concerned, yes, there is this parallel between India and between Mira, just the way that both of these are evolving. They're both really trying to find themselves. They're both growing up. They're coming of age, both of them. And it was always in the back of my mind, but it wasn't something that, I consciously tried to make parallels, like, okay, interpolate. Here's this point corresponds to this, and so on. It was more something that really started coming out at the end, after I'd written it. And interestingly enough, the question you ask about where is the sense of control, Mira is reacting to a man's world. I mean, it's a very male-dominated society. She's trying to make her way through this. Her father is controlling everything. I mean, he's really trying to push her into college, push her out of her marriage, he's meddling. Even though he's very liberal, and, on paper, he looks like a great guy. He would outperform Obama or something. So he's very liberal and everything, but he's very oppressive, too, in some way. And what she does is the only way she can assert herself, the only way she can control her own destiny is to react. So she keeps making the opposite choice, whatever he says. She's going to show her independence, and that's her main raison d'être. How does that fit into India? Think of what happened with India or any post-colonial state. Here was the West basically trying to make countries, post-colonial countries like India, behave a certain way after they got independent. And what did Nehru do? What did Indira Gandhi do? Their main thing was, okay, we are not going to do what you want. We are going to go our own way. We are going to be non-aligned. So Indira Gandhi had this whole non-aligned movement where she refused to really kowtow to the West. So I see this natural identification with Paji and the West, the colonial powers that have left, trying to channel countries that are free to be pro-West, whereas the countries themselves are determined to choose their own destiny. And, they're like children. They aren't going to do what you want them to do. They're going to find themselves their own way, and that's what India has done in some sense.
Okay. Right there.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, how do you balance your work as a mathematician with your writing life and your writing career?
Okay, so that you get the prize. Okay, great.
That's why I asked the question.
Yes, a math question. I was waiting for a math question. So let me tell you what the prize is. And you might not want it, actually. So, but this is actually a DVD. It's called Taming Infinity. And it's something that I've done. And I've actually given this talk at things as diverse as the International Literature Festival in Berlin, where they were very surprised to hear this instead of my literature talk. I've given it at senior citizen places, I've given it at artist colonies and so on. And it's doing pretty well. People really enjoy it. And it basically shows you that there are different types of infinity, not just one. So the first person who said mathematics won this, and you are the lucky or unlucky winner. But for the rest of you, you can actually download this from my website, and it's also on YouTube. So you can type in my name, but you are the lucky winner. So anyway, how do I balance things? I think in the beginning, when The Death of Vishnu was coming out, well, when I was writing it, I was, you know, it was just really like difficult. I mean, I would do research until a certain time. I remember I went to some conference for the Air Force, had a grant from them, and then came back and then went away for a month where I didn't do any mathematics, and then came back and, you know, took over as graduate chairman. And so it was really just very a lot to do both things. Since The Death of Vishnu came out, and since that was, you know, received a lot of attention and some success, then I had to really think, okay, am I going to spend all my time in research? The teaching is not so hard because you can, you know, you do it over the semester. You have your classes to prepare and you do it. But to do research in mathematics, you really need to put in a lot. So I still managed to have a PhD student, and I graduated her after The Death of Vishnu. But then I said, okay, this is I can't give full attention to both. And so what I've done now is, instead of research, what I'm trying to do is do more outreach. So I've started channeling. I'm trying to get some sort of connection between the two, synergy between the two. So I've been doing a lot of outreach projects, and that's been working. And you know, I'm sort of involved in it too, and people at the university like it. And so there's been a lot of that, and that's going to be my push in the future. Hence that DVD.
Any other questions? Gentleman down there.
Oh. Okay.
Did you have a question? I'm sorry.
No, right.
Oh, I'll get you next.
Okay. Hi. I just wonder if you could describe any of the challenges that you went through, maybe even any little transformations in writing as a male and trying to write from Mira's point of view.
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, how does one do it? I mean, it's the first thing I did was just try to read, you know, read up. That first scene you saw, okay, after, you know, I typed in breastfeeding on the internet and came up with all these wonderful pages about new mothers and what their reactions were, and that was helpful. I read things like, you know, classic texts on feminism, on Of Woman Born by Adrian Rich and other things like that. And then I didn't really talk to people, though. I didn't talk to women and say, hey, give me your life story, you know, let me put it on my in my book. Finally, though, I realized that reading is only going to get you this far. And I still hadn't written anything, so I kind of stopped reading. And I just tried to feel. I tried to imagine, okay, there's a baby, and the baby's at my breast. What does it feel like? I don't have any children, so I wasn't able to actually try it. But it was really a question of feeling and trying to enter this woman's mind in very small steps, you know, really trying to figure out how this woman thinks, how Mira looks at the world, what does she feel towards her son. And it was a long process, and it was a scary one, too, at times, because I wasn't really sharing it with women, so I didn't know if I was getting it right. But, you know, it took 7 years, and it was a very interesting process. I mean, having someone like that, you know, being so intimate with someone for that long a time.
This gentleman here.
Hi. I think some of my question lost some momentum, but was there anything from your mathematical training that has informed your writing process in terms of logic, structure, rationale of your writing, et cetera?
I think you know, one thing that mathematics teaches you is to search all possibilities. It's sort of, I think of both as sort of playing chess. If you're a chess player, you know that you have to look at your pieces and you have to sort of in your mind take a piece, make a move, and then go several moves forward, trying to see all possible combinations. Okay, I do this, and then my opponent does this, and then I can do this. You know, trying to branch out and see where a certain move will lead you into the future, projected into the future. With mathematics, it's very similar. You have variables, and you're trying to find some sort of relation between them, some sort of theorem that governs their behavior. So you try to make them move in all possible ways that they can, and slowly begin to get some intuition of what are the boundaries of what they can do. And that helps you formulate a theorem and maybe even get a proof. In writing, you have characters instead of chess pieces or variables. And again, you have Mira, you're trying to follow her. Well, what if she does this? And then, then her father would do this, and then she would do that. So you try to see different paths that the characters can take and try to optimize, if you will, the drama quotient. So that's what you can phrase it as, a mathematical problem.
Another question? Way in the back there, up on the left.
You talked about your characters going in different directions. Do they do what you expect them to do, or do they get a little unruly and surprise you doing things unexpectedly or not the way you planned for them to?
Oh, they're awful. They're horrible. I mean, I can really sympathize with Paji, the father, who, his daughter keeps going against his wishes. Because when I started this book, it was about Ashwin, the son, more than the mother. And I had this elaborate outline that I was going to follow his life, with his mother being one person and then two other people in his life who loved him and who were not able to attain him, much like the Shiva myth, the central Shiva myth. And so at some point I said, okay, the mother is going to have this intense love for Ashwin but not be able to attain him in the way that, a lover would. I started writing a chapter or two about her backstory, thinking, okay, I need to say where she came from, what happened, and I wanted to introduce something about the partition, so I said, okay, she came from Rawalpindi, which is now in Pakistan. Well, I started writing this, and suddenly I'd written 200 pages, and Ashwin still wasn't born. So I knew that, okay, she has taken over the story, and she just called the shots after that. I mean, I had to follow everything she did. It was so clear that it was her story that it would have been foolish to, try to impose my own ideas on this character. So I think at that stage, when you have such a strong character that builds up, then it behooves you as a writer to just go with that.
Another question? This gentleman here?
Mathematicians who are not fulfilled usually get out of mathematics. They don't stay and also do something else. That's rather rare. Okay. Could you comment?
When I started my career in mathematics, there was my PhD thesis, we had two papers out of that, and one paper I submitted with my advisor to this one journal that's sort of one of the top journals in my field, and got rejected. And, that was kind of, we published it in some lesser journal afterwards. But that always sort of stayed with me. And my goal was somehow to erase that insult, if you will. And so what happened, interestingly enough, is just before The Death of Vishnu came out, I was invited to be on the editorial board of that same journal. So that was great revenge, and I felt completely vindicated. And I felt, okay, I've done this now. I mean, I don't need to... I mean, the next step would have been to try and get on the editorial boards of other journals, to get more and more grants, to get more and more graduate students. And somehow, that was not the path that I wanted. So I really felt fulfilled, and I really felt that I could go on to other things. And that's why it was very natural to start putting more into the writing and putting more into outreach efforts.
Okay. Gentleman right here in the front.
Yes. You write...
Go ahead, yeah. Wait, we're recording, so...
The voices in your writing remain very interior. There's not too much third-person, authorial, intrusive description. I'm wondering, is this something that you do because you feel more comfortable in evolving it this way, or is there a degree in which you're calculatingly trying to avoid the kind of 19th century third-person omniscient descriptive voice?
Well, have you read my first novel? Would you say
yes,
that?
I have.
Because I thought that does have the third-person omniscient narrator. It is all in the third person, even though I agree that a lot of the characters are presented with their interior thoughts. But, you know, the story, especially in the first few chapters, that was the only way to do it. You had to have a third-person narrative to really switch, to flip between all these different pieces of action that were happening. In this book, I really tried to move away from that. In every way, I was trying to write a different book. So I wanted a much more expansive book. I wanted something that took place over many decades. I wanted something that geographically swept across the country. And I wanted something that was not in the third person. And so I purposely made it so that, you know, it was characters speaking to the central character, Ashwin, in the second person. And just by extension, the next book, there's only one thing left, and that's the first person. So that'll be for the next book. It's true. Maybe you're talking more about the descriptive nature, which is absent. And that, I think, is probably, just being a mathematician, I feel that, okay, if it's not necessary, it's not neat. I mean, if you can cut it out, cut it out. And so, you know, no one reads descriptions, so just cut it out. That's what I was told. So. Well, I just didn't think it was, you know, if anything was compelling, it was there. Anything that I could cut out, I did.
Okay, lady in the white in the back.
Good evening. I have a question that's just strictly about math. I was surfing the web, I think it was during the summer, and I heard that they were having a conference just on mathematics. It was somewhere in Barcelona, Spain. I was really surprised because it never occurred to me that people that are in mathematics, higher mathematics, get together and have conferences and just concentrate on one or two issues.
We have these ancient rites and ceremonies. We come naked and we do all those horrible things.
So I was just wondering what is, because the conference was on one or two issues, what is the Poincaré conjecture, and how, and also are there a lot of famous ancient Indian mathematicians who are still guiding the nation?
Well, I won't answer. I won't give you a description of the Poincaré conjecture because it you need a blackboard and so on. And plus, it's not my specialty. But the interesting thing about that is that it was a conjecture, a long-standing conjecture that finally seems to have been solved. And the person who did it is a very reclusive mathematician. They tried to give him the Fields Medal, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in mathematics, and he basically disappeared. He refused to get it. And there's a wonderful account of this in the New Yorker a couple of years ago, I think. But yeah, mathematics is, you know, we do have conferences, and we do all sorts of things. We ski as well, and, you know, it's surprising, but yes, it does happen. And there are many subspecialties. So, for example, if I went to this conference on the Poincaré conjecture, I wouldn't understand anything because it's just not my field. And even something that's, you know, I work in something called numerical analysis, even something that there are many subfields in that which I might not understand. So it's extremely specialized. There are a lot of people doing it. You'd be surprised how many mathematicians there are, how many people come to these conferences. So that was your first question. What was your second? Oh, the Indian mathematicians. Well, you know, there are long-standing Indian mathematicians like Aryabhatta, who was way back, he was an astronomer and mathematician in, I forget even which century. But in more recent times, I guess the most famous Indian mathematician is Ramanujan, who's very well known in the West as well, because he was invited by Thomas Hardy, another famous mathematician who wrote A Mathematician's Apology, to England, and they collaborated a lot. And then Ramanujan died tragically very young. There's a recent novel by David Levitt called The Indian Clerk that looks at that, and there have been other novels as well. So you should be able to find a lot of stuff about him.
Okay. Right there.
Hi. I was struck by the two readings that you gave. One was a very personal ritual, and the second was a very public ritual. And I wondered why you picked those in terms of, is it something to do with the Indian-American connection and the place of ritual in India, or... I haven't read this book, so I'm at a disadvantage with that, but I was just, interested in those two personal, public, ritualistic readings.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it, and I really should lie down on a couch and psychoanalyze myself, because I hadn't thought of that. But, both of these are from the first part, and I didn't want to give too much away, so that's sort of why I did that. And I wanted to get people interested in the story, so that was another reason. But that's an interesting way of thinking of it. What does happen in the book is that it starts with Meera talking to her son and then shifts, because we have to get the story of what happened before the son was born, the 200 pages that I wrote when Ashwin wasn't born. And so that's why you see this change in tone, and you really see it. And then the second person comes back in part three. So you will find this difference, and the two pieces that I read are representative. The first part is representative of kind of the latter half of the book, and the second part is representative of the first half of the book.
Do I have another question? This gentleman here in the front.
Two questions, one about the trivia of your writing life, and the other one about Vishnu. The first one about your life, I was following it from the Bulgarian vegetables, that article, and then meeting Mr. Cunningham in Provincetown. But I didn't understand from there how you got an agent. And then
I was very lucky, actually. What happened was just to backtrack a little for people who aren't familiar, I... was writing The Death of Vishnu as a short story, and I took a course, a writing workshop, and the teacher, Jane Bradley, said, this looks like a novella. So then I wrote a second chapter, and I wrote an outline, and I took another writing course, this time with Vikram Chandra. He's a famous Indian author. This was at George Washington University, and he said, okay, this is a very trenchant idea. And I was very encouraged, but also went into complete shock that I now had to write a trenchant novel. And I didn't write anything for a year. I couldn't. And then a friend of mine said, okay, you need to take a third workshop to unplug yourself. And so I applied for this thing with Michael Cunningham. This was only a five-day workshop in Provincetown. And you had to submit something. And I forced myself to write a third chapter. I said, okay, that's the only way. I'll only let myself go if I write this third chapter. So I did that, went to the workshop. He was very encouraging. He said, you have to finish this at any cost. And, he called me a writer, and the great Michael Cunningham calling me a writer. So then I knew, okay, I'm on to something. I have to finish this. And so I started writing some more. And I wrote about seven chapters. And then I went to this place called the VCCA. It's the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. It's a kind of writer-artist colony. You have to apply to get in. Michael Cunningham's his recommendation helped. I got in. I was there for 4 weeks. I was there for 3 weeks and 3 days, and I wrote like crazy. I wrote about seven or eight chapters in those 3 weeks, and everyone hated me because I was writing all the time. And it was just the only time in my life that's happened. So once that was finished, I came back with pretty much, you know, you could see the whole book now. It wasn't finished, but you could kind of see it. The next year, the next summer, remember I was still doing research and also I could only do this in the summer. The next summer, I applied to a more famous place called the McDowell Colony. And once again, recommendation from Michael Cunningham helped. I got in there. There, I had to read out a part of my book, the first part. There was someone in the audience who was a writer. He was also a reader for Hollywood. He read manuscripts before they actually were published and told Hollywood which of these would make a good film. Well, Miles didn't qualify for that, but he knew all the agents in New York because that's from whom he got the manuscripts. And so he told me, I know the perfect agent for you. And so I said, okay, fine. So he gave me the name of this agent, and he wrote to this agent. The agent said, you know, send me the stuff. At that time, I had no idea how easy or difficult it was to get an agent. So I sent her my manuscript, and she, you know, liked it, but she had some problems with it. She said that her exact words were that the ideas somehow sometimes overwhelm the story. So I couldn't tell, you know, okay, who is this agent? Who is she? You know, I went down to New York to interview her. I brought this long list of questions, and, you know, I had my glasses on, and I was checking them off and, you know, really trying to trip her up and everything. And finally at the end, I said, okay, grudgingly, you know, okay, fine, I'll go with you. You know, like, I haven't really seen any other agents, but I'll go with you. And she said, oh, that's really good because, you know, I was worried. And then she told me that she got about 20 inquiries a week, or 200 inquiries a week, I forget, but, you know, I felt really stupid then, and, you know, was very relieved that I'd gone with her. Anyway, she turned out to be amazing. She's got a lot of very good writers, very good young writers. She knew whom to submit it to. She submitted it to select editors, and actually all the editors she submitted it to made a bid on the book, so there was no question of it being published. So it was just one thing that led to another. I was extremely lucky. It's very hard to connect with an agent who really fits so well with your work like my agent does with mine.
The other question I wanted to ask you is about, I don't want to butcher his name, the Muslim character in Vishnu, Jalal,
yeah.
Jalal.
Right.
I've heard of the cliche falling in love, but I had never heard of falling into faith. And he's hanging from the balcony and he falls and breaks his legs and thinks he's in heaven in the hospital room. Could you just comment on falling into faith?
Well, Mr. Jalal was a very rational person, and he was always looking for something that could not be, to see if there's anything beyond this world of rationality, much like a mathematician like myself would, you know, think about. And so he was kind of a tragic comic character. In terms of his odyssey, he has these ups and downs. He's trying to pull himself up to the next level where the recluse lives because that's more spiritually enlightened, but he can't quite do it. So I interpret his fall more as something that he hasn't made it. You know, he thinks he's gone to heaven, but it's not really heaven. He's still stuck on earth. So I don't think that, I don't interpret it the way you do. But, I mean, that it's more like he's not quite made it on this try.
All right, it's about 8 o'clock, so we're going to wrap up. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you.
Please join us upstairs for the book signing.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.